CheersCast is part of the Fire and Water Network.
He is leaving for Japan tonight forever, and I never got to tell him how I feel.
Well, listen, why didn't you tell him at the goodbye party?
What goodbye party?
The one you're going to throw for him tonight. Listen, it's a great idea. I'll make it a Japanese theme. Yeah, we'll have chips and cheese. You wanna go where everybody knows your name.
Hello and welcome back to CheersCast, the podcast where everybody knows your name. I'm your host, Ryan Daly, and joining me for the finale of Cheers' sixth season, co-founder of the Fire and Water Network and the host of MASHcast, among others, please welcome back Rob Kelly. What's up, Rob?
Howdy, Ryan. I'm your closer, man. I'm closing out the season. I'm the show's version of Mayday Malone.
There you go. We brought you in for the relief. Yeah.
I'm going to give up skyrocketing home runs. I don't know what the metaphor exactly works, but, you know, we could just go with it.
He had a couple of good years, we could say.
Yeah, I haven't started drinking yet, so I have that to look forward to.
As I just mentioned before the episode began, I wanted to have you on, especially for one of the Tom Skerritt episodes, and this is the last time we see Tom Skerritt's character, Evan Drake, on the show. And obviously that, because of his connection to MASH, you do a MASH podcast. For anybody listening here who maybe it hasn't been listening to MASHcast for, I mean, you've been covering your, you just finished your own season six a couple months ago. When did you see the movie MASH?
Oh, many years into knowing the show.
Okay.
You know, I think I was always sort of aware of it, but it's rated R.
Yeah.
Or at least, I don't know if the rating system had quite come in at that point, but it was definitely an adult movie. Mm-hmm. So I didn't see it until I was a teenager. And I loved it. It's a masterpiece of a movie, but it is, as I've said on the show many times, it is like looking at like a parallel Earth version of the characters I know, because it's like I grew up with Alan Alda as Hawkeye,
right,
and Wayne Rogers as Trapper John, and here's like these other people with those names, you know, and then you're like, but wait, that's the same radar, you know, and
yeah,
they're acting a little different. So, I mean, I love the movie. The movie is, I haven't seen it in a little while, but it's a great movie that deserves all of its praise, but the show is my fandom really belongs.
It might even be weirder if it was somebody obscure playing Hawkeye, but it was Donald Sutherland. I mean, that's
a big name. Like, Elliot Gould, Donald Sutherland,
yeah.
Sally Kellerman. I mean, you know, big name stars that I was familiar with from other movies. And you're like, wow, that's Hawkeye Pierce. Well, okay, I guess so.
Tom Skerritt obviously played Duke Forrest in the
Duke
movie,
Forrest,
who was not a member of the TV, who was not a cast member in the TV show. Was that like a thing? Was that like even something like on your radar at that time? Like when you first saw it, you were like, oh, they just didn't have anything for this character on the show? Or
I always wondered, and then probably around the same time, I got a book called The Complete Book of MASH by Susie Coulter, which is this big hardcover edition. I still have it. It's on my shelf here as we're talking. And it's about as complete a book, you know, hence the title. It's about as complete a statement on the show as you're going to get. And it mentions that when Larry Gelbart, the creator of the show, MASH, was given the brief to adapt the movie, he realized quickly that three main characters was just too many. And he was like, I'm going to cut one. And he decided to cut Duke Forrest. You know, I don't know the reason for that. I don't know whether maybe it's because the movie really kind of focuses on Hawkeye and Trapper, and Duke kind of gets shuffled off to the side about halfway through the movie, that he figured, well, we don't need him. But so there was never going to be a Duke Forrest on the show. So Tom Skerritt exists in that, you know, that weird, again, that parallel universe where Shag is going to love this comparison. He's the Dr. Fate of the MASH universe, in that there is no MASH TV equivalent of that character. I'm not going to use the reference, obviously, that he would want to use.
Yeah, I was waiting for you to go there.
Yeah. No, screw him.
Well, so then, had you perhaps then seen Tom Skerritt on Cheers then, before you saw the movie? Would you have seen the season first?
Well, let me think about
this. This was 88, so...
88? No, I would have seen the MASH movie before that, because I got the MASH movie in like the mid-80s.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm sure I had seen Tom Skerritt in Alien.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah,
that's
sure.
That's
yeah,
for sure. I mean, one of the great careers. And by the way, I should mention, I have since, between the time you booked me for this episode and when we're recording it, I have met Tom Skerritt.
Oh, nice.
He was at one of those monster autograph shows that my wife and I go to. And he was there sitting next to Veronica Cartwright, also from Alien.
Also from, yeah.
And he could not have been nicer. He was very, he's like 90 years old, for Pete's sakes, but he could not have been nicer. And we actually got him to sign our Blu-ray of The Devil's Reign, Bonzo 1976 horror film with William Shatner and Ernest Borgnine and a giant devil goat costume. And he chuckled when he saw that. He was like, oh, Devil's Reign. And he's like, I don't remember my character's name on that one. We were like, okay. He could. So he was a very nice gentleman, and it was a very satisfying chat.
That's awesome. That's really, really cool. As I mentioned when we got to his first appearance earlier this season, like I knew him from this show because I was a fan of like his presence here. And then I really loved the show Picket Fences, the David E. Kelly show when that was on, where he played kind of like the perfect father figure and like the local sheriff of this small Wisconsin town. And he was just like such a wonderful, loving character, and I loved that. And then I saw Alien. I saw Alien when I was in high school, like in the late 90s. And I remember his character's death in that movie shocked me or scared me more than almost any other like horror movie. And I'd seen plenty of horror movies before then. I wasn't prepared for his death that way. And it wasn't gruesome or gory, but like the suspense, the tension that really got built up for that particular death, that messed with me. And I like how much I loved Tom Skerritt at the time. I was like, that one stayed with me for a little while.
It's such an amazing misdirect, that movie, when you think about it. And that is, you know, Tom Skerritt was by far the biggest name in that movie. Mm-hmm. And so you're thinking, well, de facto, he's the main character. And then he gets killed off. Spoiler alert, everybody, for a 45-year-old movie. Mm-hmm. You're like, wait, what? Like, you know, you're so not expecting that. So,
well, yeah, that was perfect. Like even before I saw the movie, like Scream, like that was one of those things that cued me into. I was like, oh yeah, in a horror movie, you have to kill the authority figure. Like one of the first deaths has to be the person who's responsible, the person that everybody looks up to, because that throws the world into chaos, and that makes your everyman hero that much more vulnerable if they don't have somebody to go to.
Totally. So yeah, he's a great actor. You look back at his IMDb profile, I mean, it's just an amazing list of films. He's very rarely the star. He's usually like the third guy or something like that. But it's an amazing filmography. He's been just a ton of great stuff.
Anyway, half an hour later, we're going to talk about the final episode of Season 6 of Cheers. This is Season 6, Episode 25, Backseat Becky Up Front. There's a callback to her college nickname, Backseat Becky. This one written by Sherry Aiken and Bill Steinkellner, directed by James Burrows, and the original air date was Thursday, May 5th, 1988. Evan Drake comes to Cheers to deliver some shocking news to Rebecca. It's not that he loves her, like she hopes, but rather that he's moving to Tokyo to take over the Japanese division of the company. Sam encourages the despondent Rebecca to throw Evan a going-away party so she'll have one final opportunity to tell him that she loves him. At the party, however, events and people conspire to distract Evan and prevent Rebecca from confessing her love for him. When Evan leaves, she believes her dreams of true love are over. Sam gives her one last chance, though, when he locks Evan's chauffeur in the closet and tells Rebecca to get in the limo with Evan. She does just that, taking the wheel of Evan's car. But before she can confess her love yet again, Evan reveals that he is going to Japan with his new girlfriend. Rebecca calls Sam for help once again, this time from jail, after she crashed the limo. Sam takes Rebecca back to her apartment, ready and able to finally reap the benefits of her emotional vulnerability, until she tells Sam that he is her best friend. This revelation throws Sam for a loop, and he asks her permission to leave, believing that if he stayed to comfort her, they would sleep together and it would ruin their friendship. At her pleading, he tries to resist his sexual urges for her sake, but quickly realizes how futile that is and leaves again. He calls her a few minutes later from a payphone, knowing the only way he can be her true friend is if he's not on the same couch with her. All right, what did you think about this one?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of outmoded ideas in this episode. Most importantly, payphones. That's the main thing I'm thinking of. No, I mean, of course, you've been addressing this topic since almost episode one, season one of the show, is that, you know, Sam is, I think, to modern audiences, it's a pretty startling character, the way he behaves. And, you know, you have to judge entertainment in the era that it was created, you know, necessary kind of, to be fair. And, you know, so it's not exactly right to look back on it and go, oh, boy, this guy. But there is some stuff here that's pretty rough. the stuff that Sam does. But, you know, I mean, I watch it again and I laughed. And there was even there's even a moment, and I'm sure we'll get to it, of drama. I think it's very brief. I always thought that when Cheers, the amount of times Cheers did straight drama, I think you could probably count on maybe two hands, maybe even one.
Yeah.
You know, MASH in later seasons certainly did a lot more of it. But I liked it when Cheers could get serious because the show was so funny. And I think it earned it when it would do something serious. And there's a moment here I think that's great. And I'm shocked to hear you say that Tom Skerritt, this is it for him. For some reason, I got the idea that like the Evan Drake character was multiple seasons. And I guess not. He's just season six.
Yeah, just this one. And then like they'll pretty much season seven, there are a lot of Evan Drake types before they finally settle on one of my favorite characters, Robin Colcord, in season eight, played by the great late Roger Rees.
Deliverer of the greatest single match, Cheers line in the history of the show.
Hold on to it. Oh, I will. Yeah. I will call that.
I'll say what it is.
But I love it.
They gave it to him, not any of the regulars. They gave it to him.
You're right. Yeah, like Sam. He tells Carla he's got a vulture position, like this idea of him literally swooping down to pick up the pieces of a shattered, emotionally ruined woman for his own sexual gratification. It's like, yeah, that's not cool, dude. That's not good look.
I mean,
however, as things play out in this episode, and I definitely want to talk about sort of the lasting legacy of the end of this episode, but we'll get to that. The episode begins, and this is one of those, the teaser isn't that great, and I think this might be one where the episode was running long, because I think like this is one where the teaser and the beginning of Act 1 are almost like right up against each other. Like there doesn't seem like there's a time break. But Evan Drake he's upstairs in a meeting. He comes downstairs. He asks Rebecca to go into her office to use the phone. And she tries to flirt with him. She's like, oh, you like phones? I like phones. Isn't that a coincidence? It's like, seriously, that's your come online? But,
so pathetic.
Yeah, but we get we get this bit from Cliff, and it's not one of his stronger things, but he's just like, he's complaining about the type of guy Evan is. He's like, he's the type to have his knuckle hair removed with electrolysis, and I wrote these things down. He uses a device to stop his receding hairline, and he uses a loofah to rub himself raw to get rid of his cellulite. And Woody and Norm are just staring at him like, why are you this preoccupied with beauty and grooming? And this guy? And Cliff's like, oh, yeah, it was in the last month's Soldier of Fortune magazine or something. So,
as with a lot of people in current society, every accusation is a confession.
Yeah, exactly. That's, you say that about Cliff a lot. But that's pretty much it for Cliff in this episode. We actually, like, I was kind of counting, like, the supporting players get maybe one scene or two at the most. Frasier is in this episode and never has a line of dialogue. He's just
in
the background.
When I noticed that, he pops in the background in one scene. I'm like, oh yeah, Frasier.
He's there. He's there consistently. He's there like throughout the party and everything. But we don't ever hear him talk. So Rebecca tells Sam that she thinks, you know, Evan keeps going up to have lunch at Melville's because it's close in proximity to Rebecca. So obviously he's noticed her since his divorce, and Sam pleads with her. He's like, look, if you're going to make an ass out of yourself, take it outside. And when Evan asks to talk to her over at the bar, she's like, I'm not going to make an ass of myself. And this great little bit from Kirstie Alley, she's walking across the bar confidently and just bumps into the side of a bar stool. It's so good. And she just looks at Sam, she's like, getting it out of my system. It's like, so Evan has Rebecca sit down. He's got this big news and he's really excited. This conversation is long overdue. And he's like, I've got this opportunity, but it's a big risk. And she stands up and exclaims, she's like, take it. And he's like, well, I'm moving to Tokyo to take over the Japanese part of the company or something. And she faints. Rebecca just faints. And Sam has this great line later on when he's comforting her. He's like, women faint all the time. He's like, well, in cartoons they do. I love it because when we come back, when she's alone in the, or she's in her office, and Sam has like a towel over her neck, and he's like massaging her, like comforting her, and she's saying everything was going so well, and then everything went so black.
Have they established, if they have, I've just forgotten it, the name of this company that owns Cheers?
Yes. Oh gosh, what is
it's not Weyland-Yutani.
No, it's the Lillian Corporation.
Okay. So I have a question.
Yeah.
Ryan, I'm sorry to interrupt your synopsis here, but I have a question. What business is the Lillian Company involved in that they have a Japanese division, a baseball team, and they also own a local bar? That seems to be kind of all over the place. I'm not getting a through line to their business. Are they a kind of like Halliburton, LexCorp, kind of Blackwater kind of thing? Like, what is going on with this company that they have just a Japanese division? What do they do?
They're vulnerable to corporate takeover in 2 seasons from now. So,
okay.
Are they stretched a little thin? Are they a little bit negligent? Are they like, I don't know why they own this bar, other than it just being like.
Cheers seems like a very minor thing to be involved in if you have a Japanese division.
Exactly. Yeah. You just think like they would have bought the real estate for the bar and not like actually cared about it, but which maybe that was their thinking, but who knows.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to divert. When he says the Japanese division, it's like, that's such a just quick writer lampshade of like, let's get the character out here. The Japanese division. But you guys own a local bar to the point that like they're counting the, you know, they're doing like specific like discounts and like they're that hands on. Cheers. But they also have a Japanese division. And they're also big enough that they have to have a baseball team that Sam can play on. That's very strange.
Well, I mean, if you're going to start looking at Cheers about the things that do and don't make sense. I mean,
well, yeah, of course, yeah.
No, it's
who am I to judge? I do MASHcast. That show's been running, that war's been running for 11 years.
I mean, yeah, I don't even know if the company knows how many employees Cheers has or how they get away with that.
Because
that's
three.
Still something that I've never figured out.
It's three and whatever Rebecca does. That's exactly. The employee.
Sam has this great bit when he says, you know, Evan, you know, expressed some concern. He said that every time he sees you, you do something more bizarre than the time before. And she's like, what did you say to that? He's like, oh, honey, I had to agree with him. So here Sam, like, he proposes that Rebecca throw him, Evan, this going away party so she'll have one more chance to him. And he's like, yeah, it'll be Japanese themed. They'll have chips and cheese.
That's exactly what I would do if I had to throw a themed party. I would just default to like Slurpees. I don't know, what can we have? I'm very like Sam in that.
Yeah. Sam has this line that's a little bit revealing, and maybe it's just like, again, for like the part of him that's trying to get with her, but he, in part of his like, you know, pep talk for her, he's like, he says it's important that Rebecca confess her love. He's like, not just for her sake, so that she doesn't like lose all passion and self-respect and become like the spinster. He's like, but also for Sam, and I think that like as a surrogate for the audience, he's like, I want to see how this movie ends. I want to see if the girl gets the guy. He's like, we've had to watch this agonizing, you know, melodrama for a year now. It's like, are you actually going to do something? So,
that's a good point.
Yeah. And he's like, and he finally, he gives her a little bit of a little bit of something to chew on. And he's like, he expressed some interest while you were out cold. And she's like, what did he say? He's like, gee, I hope she's not dead.
by the way, related to that, that was something I had in my notes here, and I was going to bring it up at some point, but this is a good part. One of the things that I enjoyed rewatching, I rewatched a bunch of season 6, just as you've been doing these. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I don't know. Maybe I never noticed it before, or if I did, it just didn't register with me because I wasn't like thinking about it. You know, just enjoying the show. But the way that Skerritt plays Evan Drake, at no point do I get the sense that Evan Drake even like he barely notices her existence. Like he has given her zero ground for her to think there's something here. And I think there's something wonderfully sad about that on Rebecca's, that she's just, you know, mm-hmm. like she's getting nothing back from him. in that regard. And yet she still is like so in love with this guy. So on the one hand, it's like it's a little tragic because it's all in her head in a lot of ways. But I also think that's like a really good actor's choice on Skerritt's part. Like, I feel like he's not even like he's looking past her
right.
in any given scene. And unlike what we're going to get with, as you mentioned, the other character, like the other rich guys that she's going to meet, and then Roger Rees when he shows right. up. But like Evan just, he regards her like she's furniture. And that's something just so wonderfully daffy about that. She's so in love with a guy who I you know, we're lucky if he knows her full name, you know? And there's just, I just love the way that Skerritt played that. I think there's, it's not in the script. At no point did they ever give him any dialogue where you get the sense that he's interested in her. But, you know, there's a way that an actor could look at another actor, which as an audience member, you could pick up like a vibe of like, oh, you know, maybe he's interested. He gives you nothing, absolutely nothing. And I think that's a choice for him. Or he's just like, she might as well be Carla. She might as well be Woody. She might as well be Norm. It's like, it just doesn't register. And I think that's a fun, they would change that in a later season, but I think that was a fun way to approach that character.
Yeah, and I think early on, it might have been his first appearance, like he said something like there was a rumor around Corvette that she was a lesbian or something like that, and maybe that informed like his opinion that he never even when she started kind of dating Sam, he never like looked at her or anything like, and like with this theme of every time she sees him, she embarrasses herself. You have that one coworker that you like, it never would even occur to your mind that something might happen with you romantically, because they're just like, in your mind, they're just kind of awkward and a little bit weird, and they're just kind of like on the periphery of your awareness. And it's just like, that's who she is. And he has no idea how she feels about him. And it's like, yeah, I take everything that you said, but it's even a little bit more grounded and like, yeah, he's like, she's kind of like that weird, like, how do you explain her to a coworker, like, based on their history of, like, the amount of times she's embarrassed herself in front of him?
Yeah, even though she's Christy Alley and she's gorgeous, she just radiates no sexual energy or sexual chemistry to him at all. It's kind of like what we've been talking about over MASH season 6, is like the early episodes, they were the writers, not to keep dragging my own show into this, but like, in the early episodes, they were trying to maybe see if there was some chemistry romantically between Major Winchester and Margaret. And they kept giving those two actors scenes where they would flirt with each other. And those two actors had wonderful actor chemistry, but zero sexual chemistry, just nothing. And I think they realized halfway through the season, we got to give up on this because there's nothing here.
Yeah.
And I just think that's the way Drake looks at Rebecca, as just like a functionary, and he's not even acknowledging that she's this sort of stunning woman and she's flirting with him and take it. And he doesn't even pick up on that. Like, he's just like, oh yeah, whatever. I will take it. I'm going to Japan. Like, oh, okay.
When we actually get to the party, held at Cheers, of course, everybody's saying goodbye to him. And Rebecca basically has three opportunities to say goodbye to him. Excuse me. I had to clear my throat. The first opportunity, she catches him and she's about to say everything, and Carla pulls her aside, and she's like, sorry, this is important, I can't wait, it's a girl thing. And Evan has this almost sort of casually misogynistic thing, he's like, ah, leave that to the experts, girl problem, so, and kind of walks away, and Carla's like, I know that you've got a case of the screaming thigh sweats for Evan.
That's a definite Carlaism.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like, before you tell him you love him, you gotta. And she takes out a razor and she's like, you gotta lose the mustache. Which I think is just so casually cruel, but I think in Carla's mind, she was just like, I'm gonna mess this up for Rebecca. I know this is her last chance, and I'm just gonna throw a grenade in the works and just see if I can disrupt it.
Can I make her feel more insecure than she already is?
Exactly. After that, Rebecca approaches Evan by the bar, and he gets a drink from Woody, and he's like, oh, damn, I've already changed all my American money to yen. I don't have money for a tip for Woody. And it's kind of ridiculous, but Woody's like, oh, I don't need a tip for you. And he just, under his breath, mumbles, cheap, cheap, cheap. And then Evan finds these courtside tickets to the Celtics-Laker game. He's like, hey, will you take these in lieu of a tip? And Woody's like, oh, yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. Forget about that cheap crack. And Evan's like, what cheap crack? And Woody just catches, like, thinks he's in on it. He's like, you're a prince. And I think that's all Woody does this episode, but it's so funny. I love that part. And then Rebecca's last chance, she catches him in the hall outside the bathroom. He actually surprises her, but she's about to tell him what she thinks, and then his limo driver says it's time to go, and like, he does, yeah, like, you're right, like, this is, like, sort of the culmination, because obviously she's been trying to talk to him, and he takes her hands, he's like, whatever you gotta say, just send me a telex. Like, it's, like, not even worth his time to say, Rebecca, just out with it. What is this?
And he doesn't care.
He doesn't care.
She's invisible to him.
He doesn't care. And he just walks away. And he leaves her there with her hand out after he, like, touched it. And she's just, like, standing there vacant. And, oh, old Al just waddles up after, puts his drink in her open hand and says, hold my drink, babe. And he walks into the men's room.
Brutal. Just so brutal. Oh my god. By the way, I have to mention, I love that Sam's and Rebecca's fancy farewell party to this scion of business is basically a card table with like a paper tablecloth over it and just like some cold cuts.
And nothing approaching like Japanese themed or whatever. It's like
it's the most this guy is like this, you know, captain of industry, and you're like, you want some salami on a plate? I guess that's all right. I just love that.
So Rebecca, in her tears and frustration, returns to the bar. She starts throwing glasses on the floor. Evan's driver comes in looking for his top coat, and Sam lures him to the closet and locks him in there, takes his hat. And he's like, hey, does anybody know how to drive a limo? Hint, hint. And he's like, well, I've driven a tractor. Can't be that different. And Sam just, he's like, Woody, by anyone, I meant Rebecca. And Woody, and this is the difference between Woody and Coach, because Woody comes back and he's like, well, in the future, you might try this thing that's popular in Indiana. It's called direct address. He's like, don't talk to me like I'm an idiot, Sam. But of course.
By the way, oh, hold on. Have we not seen the closet? Wasn't there an episode where we saw the inside of the closet, or was that the dream?
That was the dream. That was Diane's nightmare. Yeah.
Okay. So, because I'm always like, where did this closet? Is it because like he sends the guy in there, and the guy clearly is walking a certain distance, far enough away that Sam can kind of like keep going.
Yeah, there's
like it's that scene in Goodfellas where he's telling Lorraine Bracco to go down that alley. No, keep going. Yeah. Keep going. And I'm like, how deep is this closet that Sam has the ability to do that? To kind of be like, shut the door behind him. I'm like, okay, this is, you know, like, all right, this is a big closet.
Yeah, no, that leads to their, you know, Sam discovered the old wine cellar down there that's underneath
when
he takes out his smoking jacket and writes his poetry, yeah.
Classic.
So then, Rebecca gets in the limo, and she starts driving, and finally, she confesses everything to Evan. She tells him that she loves him more than any woman has ever loved a man, and gets nothing in return. So when she turns to, like, confront him face to face, she actually bumps her head on the glass, and there's the joke. The window, the dividing window between the front and the back of the car was up, and he heard nothing of what she said. So he rolls it down, he notices her, and before she can express her true feelings again, that's when he directs her to drive so that they can pick up Christy, and that's the young woman who will be accompanying him on his trip. And he tells her that she was very forward when she asked him out a couple of months ago, and he really responds to that aggressiveness and that assertiveness, that it was such a relief and a change for him. And you see just this whatever was left in Rebecca just break a little bit more. And
that's the scene I was talking about. I'm sorry to interrupt. But
no,
that was the scene I was talking about earlier, is that they hold on Christy Alley for just a beat, and she's starting to like well up, and I don't think it's meant to be funny. I think it's actually meant to be kind of serious.
Yeah,
and again, I like it when Jude would do that, because it's, yes, she has been clownishly pathetic in her pursuit of this guy. And they wrung laughs from that, as they should, because Christy Alley is very funny. But there's a moment where you're like, well, there's real pathos here, because she, wrongly or not, she does feel a lot for this guy, and she's finally screwed up the courage to say something, and it's all fallen apart. And that is sad. Like, you like Rebecca at this point. And so they don't – I kind of wish they had held on it for maybe even like a one beat longer, just to kind of – really let it breathe. They kind of don't, but they do have it for a moment where you're just like, you are sympathetic to this poor person. You're like, oh my God. Like, she, you know, it'd be one thing if she never screwed up the courage, but she did. And it was fate conspired against her.
Well, but not only was it too late, but I think she just realized that all of her instincts and her tactics were wrong. Yep. Like, everything else, she was so self-conscious and so neurotic, she kept waiting for him to notice her. And like, all the moments when she could have confronted him, she's like, if she had just done that beforehand, months ago, maybe things would have gone differently. But yeah, she, like, when he's like, you were going to say something, and, like, she actually, her first line, she's like, she says it, like, through the tears. She's like, this is really a lot of car to handle. And it's like, oh, is she just going to, like, stifle it and just, like, stomach this and everything like that? And that line itself is kind of sad. And then she couples it with, she's like, I can't believe I have the strength to keep from swerving into the oncoming traffic and killing us both.
That's when the show gets out of the serious moment and goes for the broad farce of, like, okay, right, Rebecca's just going to completely lose it.
Right. But blessedly, we cut away, and that's when Carla asks Sam, she's like, why did you try so hard to get Rebecca and Evan together? And he's like, I knew nothing was going to ever happen. I brought this whole thing to a boil, knowing that she would screw it up, and I could pick up the pieces. His vulture position. And she says he's got Wessonality.
Yes, a joke that has absolutely no currency to anyone born in the last 30 years.
Yeah, I had to actually, like, look it up. This Florence Henderson's, like, jingle for Wesson oil, Wesson cooking oil.
Yep, I remember those. This, remember those commercials.
Like, cooking this chicken. But I can't even, like, make the connection. Like, what is... like, what is the connection Carla's trying to make to this?
There's no connection. It's just, it was a phrase in the culture. It was like, don't squeeze the Charmin, you know, like that. I don't know if you know that one even.
Oh, God,
even as well. That was a tagline about, like, the, you know, you're not supposed to squeeze the toilet paper or whatever. Like, it was, look, the 80s was a sad time for all of us. But it was like, you know, there were commercial jingles that people, they were memes, like early memes, you know, the early version of memes. And so it just meant you had personality, you had style, and it's you know, you've mentioned on other episodes, like, Cheers didn't do topical jokes that much. And here's a very topical reference, which I just think, to past 1995, people was like, what? Is that even a word?
This,
like,
is why. This is why they didn't, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Sam gets the call from Rebecca. He's like, quote, Sam, I need you. So he goes to pick her up, and she, when we're back at her apartment, she's like, thank you for bailing me out of jail. Which now she has to reconstruct this whole scene where they picked up Evan's girlfriend, and he's like, she's really cute, and they made out in the back of the car, and she's letting Rebecca wrap the company limo around a 7-Eleven. And she calls him, she goes, Evan and his cheap imitation geisha bimbo whore got into a taxi. And then she's like, the cop asked to see Rebecca's chauffeur license. She's like, if only I had brought one, or if only I'd brought my regular license, if only I'd resisted an arrest and he just shot me dead.
And he just shot me dead.
Meanwhile, as she's recounting this whole story, this is the Sam that we don't care so much for, because as he's listening to her, he's pulling the shades, he's dimming the lights, he's turning on music, he's starting a fire. He's like, oh man, Evan Drake, what a pig, and everything like that. And she's like, I don't want you to leave. I don't want to be alone. And he's like, you shouldn't be alone. And he goes to comfort her. And she's like, I just need a shoulder to cry on. And he says, you can cry on whatever you want. It's like, oh, nice, suggestive, Sam. And then, but that, as I said, that's when she throws him for a loop. She's like, you're my best friend. And he's like, oh, come on, you don't really mean that. And then, like, when she breaks it down, which, as sad as it is, she's like, really? Like, I'm your best friend? And this kind of, like, throws everything off. And then he's like, I can't stay here. And she's like, what are you talking about? He's like, if I come for you, well, you're the next thing you know, your panties will be hanging from the ceiling fan or something. And he has to get out of there. He has to leave. And then she goes to the kitchen. He comes back, like, a second later. He's like, for the sake of our friendship, I'm just going to resist all of my sexual urges. And he sits down with her. And she's like, you know I love Evan Drake. And he's like, nope, this isn't working. And he's like, hot fire below. He's like,
that's one of the great, Sam. Hot fire down below.
It's so good.
That would be, if he wrote a book, that would be the name of it. It would be the Sam Malone autobiography, Hot Fire Down Below. Like,
this woman is just pouring her heart out, sad about being rejected by the love of her life. And he's like, this is too much of a turn on. I can't stay here.
Yeah, she could not be more pathetic and sad. And he somehow, that's still driving driving his libido. It's like, good Lord, Sam.
He's like, no, this is too arousing. I have to leave. So she goes to the kitchen. She comes up with a jar of olives and a six-pack. And she starts drinking. The phone rings. And, yeah, Sam is down at the lobby of her apartment at a payphone. And he's like, if this was what it takes to be your friend, this is what I'm going to do. And she's like, this is ridiculous. She's like, you're not going to make a move. You know how vulnerable I am. He's like, oh, yeah? Do me a favor. Check your bra. And you just see her kind of look down her shirt and feel around her back. And she's like, how did you do that? And it's like, great Lord. And that's when we cut to the end. That's when we cut to credits. And I remember, like, and maybe just like kind of like discussing it with my family, because I watched this, even though I was way too young, but I watched this with my family. I remember this when it aired and kind of being shocked that, wait a minute, they didn't end up together. Like, at the end of season one of Cheers, Sam and Diane got together. This whole will they, won't they thing, they finally brought together. I was like, they didn't do that this time. And I remember being really, really surprised. And in hindsight, kind of looking at where this whole thing goes, you see, well, these are different types of characters with different relationships. And I think this was an important right step for the show, because getting Sam and Diane together at the end of season one was the inevitable come together of both of their journeys, because they were equally in love with each other, as much as they claimed they hated each other just seconds earlier. But we knew that that was their joined union, and those were two, a leading man and a leading woman, who did love each other and coming together. This time, the situations were different, because that wasn't the relationship between Sam and Rebecca. Sam wanted to score with her, but that wasn't what she wanted. And I think if they had done that here, if they had ended up having Sam sleep with her, it would have thrown off their levels of character. It would have been a victory for Sam, but not for her. I think it would have weakened Rebecca. And I'm going to come back to this, because season 8 ends with kind of a similar situation, where she thinks she's lost the man of her dreams, and she turns to Sam as a consolation, and they do hook up. And I'm going to put it out there right now, when I do my rewatch, maybe my thoughts will change, but for the longest time, I've thought after season 8, after they sleep together, it is Sam scoring and Sam taking the lead, like a victory. But Rebecca is never quite the same. They do amazing comedic things with Kirstie Alley and the character, but it never feels like she and Sam are on the same level after that. It always feels like she's like one rung below him.
I haven't seen those episodes in at least a little while, so I would have to rewatch them. But yeah, I remember not liking that. I mean, again, not to keep drawing it back to MASHcast, but in season 6, they finally got Hawkeye and Margaret together. And I still don't think that was a great idea, because it just alters their dynamic. And one of the things I like about Sam and Rebecca being friends is you don't see a lot of male-female friendships in popular culture. You know, you just don't see it. And like, you and I both love 30 Rock.
Right.
And that features like a great male-female friendship.
Right.
You know, one of the best ones ever. And so, you know, yeah, Sam wants to score with her, but not, you know, he's also growing. I think it took a lot of personal guts for Ted Danson to want to play those new notes in season 6. I'm sure, you know, the risk of trying to come up with another Diane would have been such a mountain to climb that the risk of failing was so bad. But nevertheless, I think a lot of other actors might be like, hey, I just want to keep doing the thing that works.
Right.
But no, he wants to play something a little different. And I think that says a lot about him, that he was willing to, during parts of season 6, as Sam looked kind of pathetic, you know, really.
Yeah.
I mean, at one point, Carla's even kind of like, the mighty have fallen. Like, you know, you're happy about it, maybe, you know, from this woman. And that took a lot of guts for Ted Danson to do. So, yeah, I like that he's growing as a person. You know, I like that. Yeah, he still wants to score with her because he's still an irrepressible hound, but he respects her enough that he doesn't want to ruin it. And it's even though the joke, the show ends on a kind of lascivious note, it's a good gag.
No, it's really funny. And yeah, I think that it was a pretty bold choice for that. I mean, they did a lot of bold choices. They chose not to follow the same trope as Diane and make this Rebecca a very different character, and in essence make the whole working relationship of the show very different. And I think it would have been a mistake to have them get together at the end and just kind of repeat that formula. So instead, they did something different, and I think it works. I think it buys them a lot more time, and they do some funny stuff. So. Yeah, well, and I'll kind of come back to that idea in a few years when we cover seasons 8. Not that I think, again, I don't want it to sound like too harsh. I don't think they ruined Rebecca, but yeah, after she sleeps with Sam, I think there is some magic lost in their relationship. But anyway, for the little trivia bits, it's a little known fact, as Cliff would say, James Burrows got an Emmy nomination for directing this episode. In fact, that episode during the primetime Emmys, Cheers received a total of 9 Emmy nominations that season, which was second to any show after L.A. Law. And wow. just so you know, the shows that, or the nominations that it got, directing James Burrows, the series or comedy series Cheers, the writing for the first episode of the season, Home is the Sailor, and then the other 6 nominations were all for the actors. Ted Danson and Kirstie Alley got lead actor and lead actress. Rhea Perlman got supporting actress, and then Kelsey Grammer, Woody Harrelson, and George Wendt all got Emmy nominations for supporting actor. And all lost to John Larroquette, who cleaned house with that category for like 4 years and then said, I'm not submitting my name to this category anymore.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Yeah, let other people.
After 4, he was like, look, this is ridiculous. I got to share the love, or you guys.
And then I think, of course, Kelsey Grammer would go on to win like 12 in a row for Frasier.
Exactly. You know? Yeah,
he would become the new guy to take over.
And yet, I actually just looked this up. In all of his time on Cheers, he was only nominated twice. This was That's only one insane. Of 2 seasons he was nominated for Cheers.
That's crazy, because he crushed it from his first episode.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't believe that. Yeah. For Norm's tab, he had 2 beers this episode, which brings him up to 587 for the series. And as I mentioned on the previous episode, he has had 103 beers just this season. Yo.
Slow down, man. Slow down.
Rob, who was your employee of the week for this episode?
I'm tempted to give it to Rebecca, just because she finally screws up the courage to do something that she's always wanted to do. And like, no joke, that's really hard to do, I think, in end life. But I kind of lean toward giving it to Sam, because Sam comes through in the clutch with the whole sticking the chauffeur in the closet. I think he's doing a solid for his friend. And so I got to give it to him.
I just had that reversed. Sam was my obvious runner-up, but I gave it to Rebecca for this one. Sam did have what I think is a home run. I imagine you're probably with me, but I think Hot Fire Below is the best part of this episode.
It's just absolutely. There's another podcast I listen to about movies, and one of the categories they do is like, what would be, from this movie, is there a name or a phrase that would be a great name for a racehorse? And it's always kind of a fun category. And I think Hot Fire Down Below would be a great racehorse name. By the way, one observation about this episode that, again, my memory might be off. But when we get to episode 200 of Cheers, the retrospective, they pull like 4 clips from this episode.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that's, you know, I mean, they had 199 to perm from. That says a lot about this episode that they, you know, multiple, because they do the gag with the mustache. And then they do her fainting.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they disproportionately pull a lot from this show. So they obviously like thought it was like a premiere episode to highlight how good the show was.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. You got a directing nomination just for this one, and it was a finale. It was a big episode. So yeah, I think so. My runner up for home run, I think, is just Woody's reaction. He's like, forget about that cheap crack. He's like, what cheap crack? He's like, you're a prince. And then like Evan's reaction, like, he genuinely doesn't get it. He's like, what did I miss? He's like, what happened?
He just doesn't get any of these people. Like, no. These are working class people. That's just not his. He's just not one of those guys. He has, as a to quote Quint, he's got soft hands. He's gotten money all his life. You know, that's totally a trick.
All right. Well, Rob, thank you very much for helping me cover this last episode of the season. Where else can people find you if they want to hear more from you in the podcastosphere?
Well, I've wrapped up MASHcast for season. You and I are like kind of going neck and neck on this. At one point, you pulled it. Even though CheersCast started after MASHcast, there was one point where you pulled ahead of me.
I know. If I hadn't gotten sick earlier this year, yeah, I probably would have finished before.
Well, that was not a coincidence. But
damn it.
Thanks, Angie. We've been kind of neck and neck a little bit. But MASHcast for now is wrapped up, and I just wrapped up, or I will be wrapped by the time people hear this, I will just be wrapping up Mountain Comics for its season. So that's going to go dormant over the winter. And then I'm coming down into the point. I'm like you. I'm closing out all my shows. I'm in the last couple of episodes for All Mankind. That will be wrapping up in January, but I'm still doing Treasury Cast, and I'm still doing Fade Out, of course. So and Shag and I just restarted kind of doing Who's Who, and we'll be kind of be doing more of those. So I'll be around as always.
Very cool, very cool. All right, folks, as I said, this wraps up season 6, so probably following the normal formula, I will take a week off, and then about 2 weeks from now, I'll have a mail call episode for season 6 feedback. And then I'll take another little hiatus after that. But again, thank you, Rob, and thanks to all of you out there who listen to CheersCast and support the show by liking and sharing on social media and leaving comments on the website fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also support the Fire and Water Podcast Network on Patreon. This show, as Sam would call it, is patronized by the Right On Network and Jeff and Rick Presents Unpacking the Power of Power Pack. Go to patreon.com/FWPodcast to support your favorite show on the Fire and Water Network. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And until next time, we're closed.
Listen, I want to try this. For the sake of our friendship, I am just going to resist my sexual urges, and that's all there is to it. Now, come here. There. All right,
now... You know that I loved Evan Drake since the first time I met him.
I'm sorry, this is not working. Hot fire below.